Blog Talk Radio.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Will a strong and united America still be a force for freedom and prosperity around the world?
America has created the longest peacetime economic expansion in our history.
We are the heirs of that first revolution.
Good common sense and sound judgment of the American people. And their essential love of justice.
Well, good evening from the mountains of Northwest Georgia, and welcome to the episode of the Kudzu Vine for the last Sunday in the month of June. And this is Tim Shiflett. Of course, you folks that listen to this show a lot, you know the drill. If I'm talking first, that means that David is not here. And sure enough, he's not. David is on vacation this week, having a big time down in the Florida Keys, down in Key Largo. But Catherine is joining us from Atlanta tonight. Good evening, Catherine.
Hello, everyone. A little hoarse from all the celebrating over the weekend, but I'm here.
Hey, well, you know, you got to celebrate, right?
That's right.
there's a lot to celebrate, and we're going to get to that in just a minute. It's just going to be me and Catherine tonight. We don't have a guest. We were going to have one, but he had to cancel, couldn't make it. So we got a lot of stuff we're going to cover, a lot of stuff to talk about. It's been quite a week. I don't recall a week like this in a very long time, so let's get right to it. I would rate this week as noteworthy if ever any week in Washington D.C. was. The Supreme Court, of course, dominated the news cycles, issuing two major rulings and some smaller rulings also that, well, folks had been waiting on for months. First, a new challenge had come to them concerning the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. Now, this one questioned the ability of the law to authorize tax credits for eligible customers in the 34 states that have federal marketplaces. You know, a few of the states set up their own exchanges, mainly those states with Democratic folks running the states. But most of them have federal marketplaces that were set up automatically. And anyway, by denying this credit, 6.4 million people would have immediately lost their insurance, and Obamacare would probably... It probably would have collapsed. It probably would have ended. It certainly would have been gutted with that many people being thrown off of it all at one time, because these 6.4 million people would have had to be provided for then with new insurance by a lot of states run by Republicans or by another act of Congress, which is also run by Republicans, and probably none of that was going to happen. So the lower courts had been split on this, and shockingly, Catherine, not only did the Supreme Court uphold the law, but they did so in a 6-3 vote, which is not really close by today's Supreme Court standards. The Chief Justice spoke for the majority when announcing the decision, and naturally the dissenting reading was done by Justice Scalia. What's your take on this?
Well, I'm just thrilled, of course. I'm just so relieved for all the Americans who are relying on Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act for their health insurance that they'll be able to maintain their insurance, and hopefully more people will be able to join. And also, I can't help but think that there's conservatives running around saying, "What happened to John Roberts?" I thought he was with us, and he ended up being with them on other decisions. But I think I was really thrilled that that he was both that he was in favor and that he wrote the decision. I thought that was very good, and I think this decides it. I think, you know, okay, let's, you know, the Republicans are still talking about how if they get elected, they're going to gut Obamacare. But I think by the time the 2016 elections roll around and 2017, by the time if one of them would get elected, that they would be able to be in a position to do something, everyone is going to be relying on their health care through the Affordable Care Act so much that there will be, you know, outrage if they try to gut it at that point. So I think we're in good shape for Obamacare, or however you want to call it, going into the future. So I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, well, the president did say in his remarks that it's here to stay.
Right.
So you think he's right on that?
I do.
You know, it would make it a lot harder with a 6-3 decision. And maybe we shouldn't have been surprised, because John Roberts, you know, when his back was to the wall before, he literally saved the wall, saved the law the other time.
Yeah, he did.
In a 5-4 vote. This was a 6-3 vote. It seems like every vote nowadays is 5-4. Well, when something is 6-3, that's just a clear majority. And so
right.
I wonder how Congress is going to react to this. Now, they have tried every way they could to nip at the edges of this law. They've had 40-some-odd votes to repeal the law that have gone nowhere.
Oh, more than that. Isn't it like 70?
It might be that many now, but how many more times is Congress going to do this, or are they going to stop?
Well, we can only hope that they stop and start doing something, you know, productive instead of just trying to stop everything. Wouldn't that be nice?
Yeah, well, you know, I was thinking, you know, like you, for my part, I'm very happy. I actually have friends, and I'm sure you do, that have benefited from this law.
Oh, yeah, me too.
They have been able to use the insurance and actually find some very serious things wrong with them. One fellow I know in particular just saved his life. This insurance reform has provided a way for people who previously had no way to purchase health insurance. That being said, of course, there are political ramifications. Now, opponents of the law have got to be asking themselves why they continue to lose these challenges. And here's what I think. They don't have any alternative. They keep
exactly.
saying they will repeal and replace. Well, we get the repeal part. Place it with what? What is their plan? What if they've never come forward with anything? Then we have all of the Republican candidates for president next year. Of course, they all denounce this Supreme Court ruling. Is it predictable then?
Yes.
As you see it, that they will all run on a promise to repeal this law.
Yes. Maybe
well,
not
will
all
it
of
work?
Them.
Yeah, will it work, though, with the general election? I'm not talking about the Republican primary.
I think there's so many people now that either are relying on the Affordable Care Act or have friends, family, loved ones who are relying on the Affordable Care Act, that I think that even some of the more conservative voters are recognizing that this is really a good thing for themselves or for their loved ones. I have a friend whose mother was able to get knee replacements that she would have been in a wheelchair today
mm-hmm.
if it weren't for the Affordable Care Act. So I think people, you know, people vote their self-interest, and if it's if they have friends or themselves who are benefiting from this law, I don't think they're gonna. I don't think it's gonna resonate with them to repeal it.
Yeah.
Unless they
you
come
know,
up with some solution, but they don't have a solution. So.
Yeah. You know though, we've talked about this 1,000 times on here, that the general electorate, the makeup of it, and the primary voters that make up are just two totally different types of voters. And so I'm wondering if the Republican candidates are kind of between a rock and a hard place here, where they're going to have to run against the law to get the nomination, but then they're going to have to turn around some way and move back to a more moderate position on this law once they get the nomination. Do you think
that's
you're going
point.
To see that happen?
That's a good point. That I mean, very well could happen, and that won't sit well with the primary voters.
Yeah, and plus, by the time of the election, we're talking 18 months away nearly, we're looking at many millions more
right.
that are going to be buying the insurance from this law. So I believe that you and the president are right. I believe this time it's here to stay because it's gaining popularity. For the first time this week, the New York Times took a poll, and the majority of respondents actually approved of the law. That's the first time that's happened, at least in their polling. And the second thing is the Republicans just don't offer a viable option. How do you tell all these millions of people, well, we're doing away with this insurance, but we got nothing for you?
Right.
I'm with you. That's not going to sit well. They would actually lose some of the voters they normally would get, wouldn't they?
Yeah, I think if the candidate that prevails in the primary is talking about repealing and then switches over and supports the Affordable Care Act after they win the primary, then they're going to lose their primary voters. If they don't switch over, they're going to lose their general voters. So they're kind of, like you said, between a rock and a hard place. It's a fine line. I don't know how they're going to walk
yeah.
that line.
And
It'll be interesting to see.
If from a Republican standpoint of those candidates, if only that was all they had to worry about, because wait, the Supreme Court gave them plenty more to think about. So let's move second giant ruling. This ruling was issued at week's end that many, many, many people had likewise been waiting for by a 5-4 vote this time. They ruled that same-sex marriage is basically constitutional. So the 13 states, Georgia among them, that had banned same-sex marriage now must allow it. 57% of Americans now support it. It's a record high. 39% oppose it. So is this it for that issue? Is this issue
yeah.
settled?
Will
it even be brought up then next year?
The only way that I think it might be brought up is if the candidates on the right want to talk about activist judges and the importance of being elected so that they can select any future Supreme Court justices, so that we don't have this, you know, travesty of the Constitution and blah, blah, blah. But I don't think that this law, I don't think marriage equality, I think it's a settled issue. I think the ruling was very clear. I don't think there's any really way to challenge it. And so, I mean, they can talk about how they might disapprove it, but I don't think they can do anything about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think there will be some virulent talk in the primaries. See, I don't think guys like Huckabee, Santorum, you know, those guys that really want to appeal to the religious right voters, which is a significant group, the Republican primary electorate, they're not going to be able to ignore them. So they're going to go hot and heavy right after that vote. That's their niche. That's where Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, those two in particular, are very comfortable. Some of the other more conservative people running against the establishment folks are going to need those voters too, and I don't think they're going to be able to ignore it. Unlike, though, the Affordable Care Act, they might be able, at least in the primaries, get away with talking about this by leaning on that angle you were just talking about. Activist courts come at it from that way. Because they really got to be careful now because so many of the American people support this, don't they?
Exactly. Exactly. They've got to be very careful.
Bless their hearts. Again, they're kind of between a rock and a hard place, and you got to be right about something else. They've got to just be scratching their heads and thinking, what was President Bush thinking when he put John Roberts on the Supreme Court? What is this man drinking? Of course, Roberts now sided with the minority on this particular issue, but you know what people are going to remember? It's the Roberts Court.
Right.
See, he's the Chief Justice. They're always going to call these decisions, no matter where he came down, as decisions from the Roberts Court. Not to mention, there are, you know, everybody can count. The liberals in this country can count on 4 votes on the Supreme Court. Well, they keep getting 5 and 6.
Right.
And so the Republican voters in this country, the conservative voters in this country, have got to be wondering, who are their presidents appointing? Why are they not vetting these people more carefully? Because I can't think, in my memory at least, of a Democratic appointee who went over and voted with, you know, the conservatives on every issue. That doesn't happen. But some Republican appointees actually go the other way, and they always have. Remember Earl Warren, you know. It's just weird the way this is happening in the Supreme Court. So we've got 2 major victories for the president this week. Now, before we came on, Catherine, you had mentioned another decision that the Supreme Court, a lesser known decision, because, well, frankly, these other 2 decisions just, you know, smothered everything else off of the front pages. But there
right.
was
well,
another
actually,
one that you felt was very important. Won't you throw that one out there for us?
Well, this is the one about housing, fairness in housing. And I'm just going to read you a little bit about it because I'm not an attorney and I can't say it as well as the attorney that wrote this. So the liberal justices, this was a 5-4 decision, ruled that someone suing under fair housing law does not need to prove that a developer or the government knowingly discriminated, only that the policy had a disparate impact, something that can often be demonstrated with statistics. So this means that if you believe that you were discriminated in some kind of housing transaction, that you can sue, and you don't have to prove that you can sue for discrimination if you believe you were discriminated against, and you don't have to prove that it was intentional. So this is an important decision for fair housing. And so, you know, we should be I'm thrilled with this decision as well. So it's, you know, housing is an import, a very discrimination in housing still goes on, and it's an important hurdle for us to get over. And it's another thing, like, we're all very excited. You know, I've been involved with the LGBT community for a long time as an ally. And, you know, everybody's thrilled about the marriage equality decision. But in Georgia, we still have, you know, no LGBT members of the LGBT community can still be discriminated against in housing and employment. So, you know, we haven't conquered all the challenges for all our communities. So we have to remember that there's housing and employment discrimination that still goes on in this country and in this state. So, I celebrate the wins, but we have to keep our eyes on the prize and know that there's still other issues to tackle.
Well, the major deal here is, you know, that we've talked about on here before, it is very, very, very difficult sometimes to prove discrimination in a court of law unless you just have drop-dead proof, witnesses, something written, something. So these cases were just almost impossible to win. This opens it up. This opens the door where the plaintiff really has a great chance to win these cases now, doesn't it?
Yes. So that's good. You know, we are
outstanding. I would say the Supreme Court has done a pretty good week's work. I don't normally say that, by the way.
No, I don't either.
About our Supreme Court, especially in recent years. So we have two momentous Supreme Court decisions. We also this week had a major trade deal passed by Congress. Now, I wasn't for that deal, but still, it was a victory for the president. And add to all of that, that remarkable address that he made on television Friday afternoon at that funeral that ended with him leading the congregation in Amazing Grace. I've honestly never seen anything like that.
I was crying.
So was this the best week this president has had while he's been in office?
Well, you know, I mean, I think you have to remember that it started out very sad.
Uh-huh.
You know, we started out with the massacre in South Carolina, and so I think we started out very sad and ended on a high note, and I think that's good. But
legislatively speaking, he just had a marvelous week, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and, you know, judicially, absolutely. And I think, that his eulogy and, you know, this Amazing Grace, leading Amazing Grace, was also was a good counterpoint to the tragedy. I think that it brought that everyone that was there, brought all of them together, and I applaud his words, and his emotion were so front and center, and I think I'm hoping that we see a more courageous. I mean, I think the president is very courageous already, but I'm hoping that this the response to this and the response to these judicial decisions will give him a little bump, so maybe he'll be a little more courageous and a little more outspoken as we move into the final months of this administration.
Yeah, you touched on a couple of very important items there. First of all, the word emotion. Obviously, you don't put that word with this president that often because he's not one to show emotion. Cold as steel is, you know, I don't know if I'd use the word cold, but this guy doesn't seem to rattle. He doesn't seem to show a lot of emotion, but he really, really, really showed it at that funeral,
yes.
Especially in the closing moments of his address, and I just thought it was wonderful. And the other thing you touched on is this president has 19 more months in office. He never has to run again. He never has to face the electorate again, either as a candidate or in midterms. All of that is over. So he's really free to become more aggressive in pursuing his agenda, isn't he?
He is, and I really hope he is strengthened by the incredible support that, you know, by watching the response to these judicial decisions and by the response to his eulogy yesterday. I think, you know, everyone was moved by it. Whether you like the man or not, you had to be moved by that eulogy if you watched it. And so I'm hoping that that positive response to the activities of the week will bolster him a little and give him a little more, you know, a little boost so that he will be more willing to be more outspoken and, like you said, strengthen his legacy. Though, I mean, I don't think there's any question now, his legacy is the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, yes,
and that one, it's
set in stone for the rest of his presidency, for certain. Also, he will be remembered as the president in which same-sex marriage became the law of the land. Who would have thought that 10 years ago we would have seen this?
Oh, no.
It happened so quickly when it happened. Just a remarkable thing to witness. If that wasn't enough, then we have the politics of the flag, I guess
is the
way I have to put it. In this case, of course, I mean the Confederate flag, remarkably, all over the place, especially down south, these flags are coming down.
Yep.
And obviously, though, you know, I'm going to say it up front, there are some who are not happy with this development, but it really complicates things politically. The flags are largely being brought down by Republican governors and other elected state and local officials. So far, the GOP presidential hopefuls have left this one alone, calling it, I believe, an issue to be resolved by the individual states. Are they right, or is this just an excuse they're using to avoid taking a stand on it?
Oh, they're absolutely using it as an excuse. The only thing I have to say about, I mean, I'm relieved that they're down. I think they're horrible commentary on race and slavery and holding on to, you know, the ugliness that was the past. And I don't even think they belong in a museum, but whatever. The only thing that worries me is that I know you remember that after the president was elected, a lot of people who are not in touch at all with the realities in American culture were like, okay, well, racism's over. Now we have a black president and it's all over.
And
my fear is that they're going to be like, okay, all the flags are down, so racism's over. And we know that's not true. We know that it is still a very real problem and a reality for, you know, millions of Americans that face racial prejudice in all walks of their lives, from housing to employment to just walking down the street, to shopping, to driving, to everything. So my fear is that there are some that will say, "Oh well, now we've solved that, and now we can move on." And I don't think it's that simple. Again, I'm really glad they're coming down. I think it's a great gesture, but it is not a solution.
You know, my thing is always, that's always stuck in my craw about it is this. Now, I personally don't like the flag, don't want it in my house, blah, 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 because to me it represents a couple of things that, a couple of the sadder episodes in our nation's life.
Exactly.
That being the secessionist movement, although that particular flag did not fly over a Confederate state house or the Confederacy itself. It came into vogue sometime after that.
Right.
And the Klan brought it into vogue. The anti-civil rights movement resurrected it. And so I perfectly understand that when African Americans have seen that flag coming in their lives, generally bad news was coming with it. Of course, they would hate that flag. And I don't like that flag. My thing, though, with that flag is this. It should not fly at an official government building because it's not an official flag. If a person wants to put it on their property, on their T-shirt, put it in their house or put it in a museum dedicated to that war, whatever, you know, have at it. But they need to come down from the South Carolina State House grounds. They don't need to be waving over the Chattooga County Courthouse down here, which I am ashamed to say they are, and the commissioner down here, who let him do it to start with, has now reversed himself a month later and told him, no, take that particular flag down. But I just don't think it should fly over official government buildings. And let me add, any other flag that's not an official flag. I don't want to see the flag of Disneyland flying over the
right.
courthouse either. The Confederate flag may have a place for some people who revere it, but it does not have a place on the grounds of a building that is paid for by all the taxpayers. The American flag belongs there. The state flag belongs there. And if the county happens to have a flag, it belongs there. Would you agree with that, Catherine? That no,
I agree with that 100%.
No unofficial flag or display
yeah.
should be at an official place like that.
Right, I agree.
That was
if only
always
they would
my
listen
thing.
To us, we would solve all the problems.
Yeah, that was always my thing about the Ten Commandments being displayed, over there in Alabama. Well, I'm not against the Ten Commandments. Who in their right mind is? Even if a person is not a Christian, those things are a good guidepost to living a good moral life. But they just don't belong on the grounds of a government building. Where they belong is in our houses of worship and in our homes.
Well, you know,
right?
They're posted at the Georgia State Capitol, too.
Yeah, and I'm not part of that.
I'm not either.
I'm not. I know some people say, oh, you're an apostate or whatever, and I got news for them. I was raised in the Southern Baptist Church, but that's another story. So, as if we didn't have enough news this week, we got this Confederate flag, so let's get back to the politics of it, because there's going to be politics. I don't think that the Confederate flag will be a major issue in the general election. But what about the Republican primaries, Catherine, particularly in the South? Will the voters insist that these presidential candidates that are trying to avoid it take a stand on it?
Oh, boy, I hadn't even thought about that.
Well, think of who the voters are in the primaries.
I just couldn't imagine they might actually that might come up, and it'll be interesting to see how the candidates respond, because it's really, you know, it stirs up all kinds of ugly, all kinds of our ugly past. And
if they're trying to be
a more diverse party, that's not the way to do it.
Of course it's not, but some voter at some town hall with the television cameras there, or some bright-eyed reporter at a debate or something, is going to ask the question, should that be viewed as another intrusion into local affairs by an abusive government?
And they will all probably say yes.
And that would probably not look good, because then the next day the newspapers would trumpet the fact that they spoke out in favor of retaining the Confederate flags. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, we're back to that rock and hard place again, aren't we?
Yeah, and the Republicans just can't seem to get away from it. I mean, they're like, they've got a whole lot of rocks and a whole lot of hard spaces to try to
get
through.
And it's all hitting them at one time. That's the amazing thing. In the space of just a couple of weeks here, boom. Of course, I'll be honest, I wish this flag thing hadn't come up in this way, because what brought it to the forefront, of course, was this terrible tragedy and just a heart-rending loss of life of some wonderful people in the sad way they left us. And, you know, I do wish the flag thing had come up in another way, not this way, but... You know, the issue is here. It is going to be a political issue, because we're talking about states like South Carolina, Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, states that have been voting not only red, but pretty reliably red. And the Republicans just honestly cannot afford those states I just named to be a battleground next year. If Georgia is a battleground, they're in desperate trouble, right?
Yeah, I agree. I think it's going to be it'll be really interesting to see how the candidates respond, and how the conversation develops around the flag, around the Confederate flag, and marriage equality, and to a lesser point, the Affordable Care Act. I think there's going to be a lot of a lot of a lot of discussion of states' rights, which is also, you know, a hot button for African Americans and those of us who understand what states' rights means. In many ways, and so I'm waiting. It'll be interesting.
You know, the funny thing, while they are struggling with these brush fires that are being lit right under them, over on the Democratic side, of course, we're just running a traditional race and talking about a few issues, and you know, obviously the Republicans want to be spending their time right now just throwing firebombs at our front runners like Clinton, personal firebombs, I might add, and they're not able to do that. And speaking of Republicans, the Republican field right now is already at 13. 13 of them already. That's without Walker getting in yet. That's without Christie getting in yet. Man, they might end up with nearly 20. And a new addition, I guess, is actually a replay of an old fan favorite. Our good friend Donald Trump has thrown his hair into the ring. Did I say hair? Not that.
Yeah.
I did.
Well,
oh,
I think,
that was
I think his hair is a hat, so.
He's thrown his hair into the ring. And he's already managing to stick his foot in his rather large mouth. I mean, is this guy for entertainment purposes only, Catherine? Is that
you know,
the deal
is? You know, at first I was like, oh, you know, this is a joke. You know, no one cares about Donald Trump. But, you know, I've heard some other people talk about it and, you know, some of the pundits. And some people are legitimately concerned about him because he does draw a lot of attention. You know, he, you know, you can ignore, like, Lindsey Graham. Like, you know, he's forgettable. A lot of these guys are kind of forgettable, but Donald Trump draws a lot of attention, and he gets so fired up about things that, you know, people respond to that. So, I mean, if he does actually run, you know, he says he's going to run, but he's got, what, 30 days to actually file the paperwork. Some people have suggested that he's just, it's just publicity for the next round of whatever his TV show is, Apprentice. And which I guess starts in the summer. I don't know. I don't watch it. But it'll be interesting to see. I keep saying it's going to be interesting. It will be if he does actually, because, you know, last time he never really did run. He never actually filed the paperwork.
That's true.
He threw his hat in the race, but then he backed out before he actually was a real candidate.
That is true.
I get the feeling that he's more serious about it this time. But
in the meantime, Catherine, in the last election, the president got 71% of the Hispanic vote, and Mitt Romney only got 27%. The first thing Trump does in his announcement is go to talking about Mexican immigrants and all the bad things they bring up here. Isn't he just going to kill the Republican Party's chances with Hispanic voters, no matter who the nominee is, by saying stuff like that?
Well, I think unless he becomes an also ran, you know, unless he, you know, comes in at the bottom with, you know, 1 or 2 or 3 points, if he gets up into the, you know, 9, 10, 12%, then yes, it's going to hurt the whole ticket, the whole list of primary voters with the Latino vote, and more power to him.
Well, here's the deal about maybe whether he's serious or not. We'll see. And this, let me qualify this by saying this could just be an announcement bump. He's in the news, la-di-da. Brand new Pew Research poll has Bush running first and Donald Trump running second now in the race for the Republican nomination.
Okay.
Oh, please, not Trump, please, no. No, I mean, let's get serious for a minute. Please, not Donald Trump.
Yeah, if only for our international reputation and nothing else.
Uh-huh. Okay.
My brother, our listeners don't know this probably, but my brother lives in Brazil. And this week I got several emails from him. Saying, what the heck's going on up there? You know, first it was the shooting, then it was the flags, and then it was Donald Trump. And he lived in New York for like 25 years, so he's got a lot of opinions about Donald Trump. But he was like, he lives in Brazil, and he is has lived in Brazil for a long time, so he's very much a part of the culture there. And he's like, y'all look like fools with someone like Donald Trump running. So.
Well. Topic number 6 for the evening. Let's jump over and talk about the Democrats. We hadn't really done that tonight, but we got to mention Bernie Sanders. He's because he's actually made some movement in the polls since he got into the race. The most liberal group of voters is really warming to him. He has especially moved in New Hampshire, which is right next door to Vermont. Does he represent any realistic threat to Hillary Clinton?
So here's what I think. I don't think there's any chance that she's not going to get the nomination. I think
mm-hmm.
that's. But I think that what Bernie Sanders and I think Martin O'Malley at the same time, what I think they do is they strengthen the platform. They
mm-hmm.
expand and strengthen the platform. So it,
mm-hmm.
it in some ways, I'm sure that Senator or what do we call her? Secretary Clinton, I'm sure sort of feels like, oh my God, I'm going to have to talk about these things that I don't really want to talk about. But I think that it's good that we talk about them. I think there's,
mm-hmm.
you know, income
mm-hmm.
inequality, some employment and trade issues that both Martin O'Malley and Bernie Sanders will bring to the forefront that might not be as comfortable for Secretary Clinton to talk about. I think she can talk about them. I think she's got clear and strong opinions about them, and I think that we, if she has the chance to explain her positions, that we will embrace them. But I think it does force us to expand the discussion, and I think that's good.
Well, actually, it could kind of be a blessing in disguise, couldn't it? Because now if, say, we have 4 to 5 Democrats in the race altogether. Hey, 4 to 5, there's enough to have ourselves a debate and get on TV and get some exposure and not leave the whole summer and fall television schedule to the Republican Party, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it could be a lively and friendly debate. Those could be very lively
uh-huh.
and friendly debates.
Yeah, I picture our debates as more geared toward policy discussion, while the other side, because of the very fact that there are so many candidates, there are going to be some that are going to be looking for that breakout moment.
Yeah,
and so they're
going
to try to use these debates as a gotcha type
yep.
thing. You know, say the right thing and you're in the top tier, that sort of thing. So I think we're going to see two different types of campaigns run, and I think that's really going to help us because our side is going to be talking about a lot of issues that a lot of people care about.
That's what I think,
now,
too.
And now about the Sanders voters, though. If she goes on, as is expected, obviously, to get the nomination, will the Sanders voters come back to her?
Well, I mean, I think some of that depends on Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
And how he talks to them, you know, if he encourages them to support her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think some of it will depend on how she behaves and interacts with him and with and in the debates. If she doesn't, you know, go after him and doesn't belittle him and dismiss him, I think that will go a long ways to, you know, improving the relationship between his supporters and improve the possibility of them supporting her. Surely they understand that Hillary Clinton is a better choice than Jeb Bush, Donald Trump, Scott Walker, you know, Marco Rubio, you know, just start naming them, than any of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes, you know, I admit sometimes our voters on both extremes tend to look for pure candidates who are, you know, with whom they agree 100%. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
I admit that when I was younger, I probably fell into that camp, though I never didn't vote. I always voted for a candidate. But I think I'm hopeful that they will recognize that this is, you know, like every election, every single election, it's important to vote for the person who you think is has the chance to win and has the best vision, the vision that matches your vision the closest, and it doesn't have to be pure.
You know, Bernie has always been a good trooper. Even though he's been an independent socialist, he has always been a big supporter of democratic initiatives, of democratic policies, and of democratic presidents. I would have to think that at the proper time, if he were to drop out of the race, he would accompany that with an endorsement of the nominee.
I would hope so.
I would just have to think so. I'm pretty sure it looks to me like he's going to be able to get a few percent in about every state he runs in. If he decides to go to the whole way, he can go to the convention with a pretty good block of delegates, and he can have a prime speaking slot at the convention. He can be part of this process.
Right, and he can help. He can help define the platform and define what we talk about.
Yeah, and he can help our candidate get elected, too, and I believe
right.
He'll be right there for us. I'm looking, and I see we got about 8 minutes left, and I didn't want to get out of here without doing what I guess what I would call a wrap-up topic. For the last few years, and we've talked about a lot of it tonight, there have been a series of great big social, civil rights, health care, education issues to work their way into the national political debate in a major, major fashion. Now, the gay marriage issue is probably a done deal. So, too, for the immediate future at least, is the Affordable Care Act. Kind of leaves a vacuum, doesn't it? What is the next big issue out there, Catherine?
I think it's going to be income inequality.
You know, that's a very good one.
I don't know how we solve it. I think about it a lot.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. I don't know how it... you know, I don't know how we bring jobs back to this country and still maintain, you know, and companies still remain. If you could see me, I would be putting in air quotes, competitive. I don't know how we, I just don't know how we do it. I don't know how we, you know, fix our housing so that, you know, we have fair and equal housing opportunities, which is part of income inequality. I don't know how we lift people out of poverty. And all of this, all of it is under the bigger issue of education, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And
no.
I don't know. I just don't know. You know, there's a lot smarter people than me that are thinking about this and talking about it.
Yeah.
And I hope that they're coming up with ideas and policies and principles and initiatives that will help us solve this. Because I think if we can improve education and make sure that, you know, there is a path out of poverty through education. And I also think that some of the prison reform, some of the reform in criminal justice and especially in juvenile justice that we've seen, and I will give a little bit, a teeny tiny itsy-bitsy bit of credit to our governor on some of the work that he's done on that. I think that's a big step. I think we have to look at sort of like criminal justice, education, and housing, and those three things sort of are the overarching thing that helps us bring people out of poverty?
There's a couple of more things I wanted to throw into the mix. You mentioned smart people thinking about these things. One of those smart people that I love to listen to talk, and he does a series of these little talks on the Internet, Robert Reich.
Yes.
Brilliant man. And he made a very astute point about income inequality in this country, and it concerns labor unions. In the 1950s, one-third, a little over a third, actually, of the workforce was organized. And as labor unions have declined in this country, so too has the middle class, because
oh, yeah.
they were all middle-class jobs. And let me qualify that by saying the people didn't leave the unions. The union jobs went overseas.
Right,
that
exactly.
ties into this other thing that I don't like, and that's all these trade deals. I'm a fair trade guy, not a free trade guy. You know, I believe in treating the other guy like they treat us. And it seems like these trade deals have been something of a one-way street. I hate to oppose the president on anything, but I'm directly opposed to the president on this new Trans-Pacific deal.
I am too.
It just means more jobs, good-paying jobs, to manufacturing jobs heading overseas. And I don't think we can address income inequality in this country without a manufacturing base. And that's what we've lost. That's where the middle-class jobs for working people were. In a service economy, you're just not going to get those kind of good-paying jobs. And you couple that with at least one of the major parties in this country supporting legislation that gives even more tax credits and things to the richest among us. And it just gets worse and worse and worse and worse. And
it does get worse and worse and worse. And then I also think... Okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask the question. When is it enough?
It's never enough.
When is it enough for these guys?
It's never enough. It's never enough until they have more.
Yeah, what was the point you were about to make?
I was going to say that I think this is also ties into education. So one of the things that I've always, that for the last couple of years I've been, you know, talking about, I don't know if I've talked about it on the show or not, but when I was a teenager in high school, there were a couple different paths that kids took. So, you know, kids who were smart and who had, you know, a higher education was something that they recognized they could achieve something. They wanted to be doctors or they wanted to be teachers. So that was a natural progression for them. But then there were other kids who, you know, maybe they were artists, and so they went to art school, to two-year
mm-hmm.
art school. Or they liked to work with their hands, so they went to, you know, they learned how to be carpenters or electricians or they just wanted a job that they could go to and work all day and then come home, and that was it. They weren't looking for necessarily a career. They were looking for a job. And so they went to be an apprentice for a plumber. And those were all good, well-respected, good-paying jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody looked down at them for, like, choosing not to go to college. It was fine. It was accepted. You know, some people did that, some people didn't. But I think now we've escalated the idea of college is like for everyone. Everyone's got to go to college. Every graduating
uh-huh.
senior has to go to college. And if they don't, it's somehow they become less than. It's, oh, they
mm-hmm.
couldn't go to college. Well, college isn't right for everybody. Or maybe
right.
they need to take a couple years off before they go to college. Because look at the debt. You know, these kids come out of college now, and they've got, you know, $100,000 or more of debt, and they may or may not be able to get a job. I don't know about you, but the last time I tried to find an electrician, it was hard.
Hmm. Well, on that note, I'm going to have to call it a night because we just went from...
We just went
into extra time, and I wanted to make a couple of announcements right quick. Number one, that I looked at the board and saw that we had a caller. Right as I reached for the button to put them on, they were gone. Let me apologize to you, caller, whoever you were. Secondly, we will not be on next week. So everyone remember that. We'll be taking off for the weekend of July the 4th. We want everybody to have a good one. And we will return, with David the following week. So, Catherine, you have yourself a great July the 4th.
You
too. And we'll talk to everybody in a couple of weeks. Been a great show.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Good night.
Good night, guys.